us, at the border between the light and the dark, stands Castle Grayskull. For countless ages, the sorceress of Grayskull has kept this universe in harmony. But the armies of darkness do not rest, and the capture of Grayskull is ever most in their minds. For to those that control Grayskull will come the power. The power to be supreme. The power to be almighty. The power to be masters of the universe.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective's look at Masters of the Universe.
Everything comes to he who waits, and I have waited so very long for this moment.
Part of Percolated Media's He-Man Retrospective Series.
Excellent!
With a new Travis Knight-directed Masters of the Universe movie coming out this summer, Garrett.
So, how does it feel to be the mighty warrior?
Adam.
It's always been between us.
And Matt.
Help! Help! Get me out of here!
Are set to review both cinematic iterations of the popular 1980s cartoon.
I have the power!
Starting with the 1987 Dolph Lundgren film.
He-Man, thank the sorceress you're alive!
I've been looking for you!
And ending with the Amazon Prime Pictures film.
Does it feel good?
These podcast hosts will decide if one or both movies actually have the power.
Whoa, all hell's breaking loose out there. Let's see what's up.
So get ready to lean your head back and laugh, podcast listeners.
Time for talk is over.
The Percolated Media Masters of the Universe review begins now.
Come on, we're moving in.
Masters of the Universe was released August 7th, 1987. Budget on this was $22 million. Box office, $17.3 million. And this was directed by Gary Goddard. Well, since we started our own venture, I don't like to strong-arm these guys into doing retrospectives. We all kind of agree, we'll do this, we'll do that. But this was one I kind of insisted that we do because we are getting a new He-Man movie this year. Adam, would you have ever thought after the release of this movie we're about ready to talk about, we would get another He-Man film?
No, not in this type of format. No way. Because there's been rumors about this being redone. It feels like ad nauseum every 5 to 6 years.
Yeah, there's one point in the mid-2000s where John Woo was looking like he was going to do one. There's concept art being released about that that got people kind of excited. I don't know if that was fan-made or not, but that kind of went by the wayside. Now, I have a huge history with this character. Matt, you were saying before we hit record, you have almost none.
I am aware of his existence, and that is the fullest extent that I am familiar with, because you got to remember, and I'll play this card once again, my generational timeline is different than yours, which is my nice way of saying you guys are old as fuck, but I miss the He-Man. I miss the He-Man train, not a child of the 80s. And of that period, He-Man, Transformers, Thundercats, G.I. Joe, none of them really appealed to me as a kid. The closest would be Ninja Turtles, and even then, I kind of somewhat distinguish them from those because they had their roots in comics before the animated show, but be that as it may, I know He-Man, like if you put the pictures of it, I know it from the memes. Between him and Skeletor, I have my own collection of memes, but that's my knowledge of this property is, to quote another 80s movie, less than zero. So these two movies we're reviewing, I'm going to be asking a lot of questions, and everyone take my opinions with a grain of salt, because I've never watched the show, I never watched the one that Kevin Smith was involved in, but I know what they are, and that's all I have to say about that.
All right, well then Matt, you can kind of sit back for about 5-10 minutes, because me and Adam are going to probably wax poetic. Adam, what is your history with He-Man, sir? I don't think you and I got the friends early in high school, so obviously this was way in the background. But do you actually have a history with He-Man?
I played with He-Man. Phrasing. I watched He-Man. I bought the toys. I had, and I got in an argument with somebody recently online when I was waxing rhapsodic about old figures because they were like, no, there was never a flocked Panthor. I was like, bullshit, because I had that purple cat frickin' with a flocked finish. So yes, there was the comics tie-ins that were done. And I mean, to go into something else that the three of us love, because we're all big men child here, I used my He-Man toys in my WWF ring so that some of us could battle those, you know, same size WWF figures against our He-Man figures.
Yes, I mean, Adam, this was Adam. I was going to bring this up later, but yeah, remember Moss Man?
Yep.
Me and my friend would put him in a WWF ring. We call him Big Moss Man, so that we didn't have to buy Big Moss Man. That was what we did. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I had wrestlers, you know, coming down on the back of Battle Cat into the ring, you know. So yeah, I mean, He-Man was one of those toys that was just, you know, look, the Star Wars figures were a little smaller, and then post Return of the Jedi, you know, there wasn't a hell of a lot that was coming. You know, you still had them, but they weren't there. G.I. Joe was never really my jam. He-Man kind of, I mean, it was it. It really was.
Yep. That's pretty much my history as well. I had toy upon toy upon toy. The reason is because my mom, as you know, Adam, she worked for Raley's for a long time. She'd go to these toy shows and things that they would throw in certain parts of the country, and she would come back with boxes of them for Christmas and my birthday and whatnot. So I had a lot of them as well. I remember specifically I had a big He-Man puzzle, and me and my dad would sit, and you want to talk 80s, we would sit and he would watch Magnum P.I. as me and him sat and did this He-Man puzzle. One of my favorite puzzles. Awesome. I did it over and over. And I remember there are times when I had Thriller going on in the background as I put it together. You talk about 80s. So yeah, He-Man was a big part of me. I also intermingle toys, except the He-Man and Star Wars universe is always intermingled, because Forces of Bad would join up with Darth Vader, and him and Skeletor would fight He-Man and Luke Skywalker and his rebels. Big, big thing. So there was no way I was not going to do this, because I cannot believe it either. We are getting a new movie from the director of Bumblebee. Now, Matt, you know, I was going to say this for the end, but I'll talk about it right now. Bumblebee, when we did it, we were all like, wow, the last night was the worst Transformers movie, and now we're going to follow up with Bumblebee. And while we weren't huge on it, we heaped a little bit of praise. Is there a way that Travis Knight can make Masters of the Universe at least as good as Bumblebee?
Hopefully, yes, so I can have an enjoyable experience. And quite frankly, I don't know what's the worst Transformers movie anymore, because they all just blend together in my head beyond the first one. And if you ask me to watch them again, I will hand in my resignation papers. And it's also been a while since I've seen Bumblebee, but having seen now, we've gotten two trailers for this new movie. As someone who knows nothing, like I said, based on aesthetics and based on, sometimes it's hard to read tone from a trailer, but it looks spirited. But I can't say if it's faithful or not based on what's depicted. And I do have some concerns. Is it going to be accessible for me as a newbie, or is it going to be one of those things where it's too much inside baseball and I sit there just watching it, not being able to follow it? Are there going to be too many references? Are they going to explain the lore? So I have cautious optimism, but I'm not excited to go see it, if that makes any sense.
I hardly ever fanboy out anymore. It's really hard for me to do it. But when that first trailer was released, I was sending these guys screenshots saying, look, there's Beastman. Look, there's this. I was pretty excited. Adam, are you excited for this new movie?
Maybe. I'm going to be glad to bring it in. I wish I could tell my kids, oh my God, this is going to be such a fun thing that you enjoy. My kids have no reference to He-Man. So that's where I do think there's a misstep. You know, they've done a couple different animated series. You know, there was one that was very kiddified, almost like a Teen Titans Go type version of He-Man that they did recently. My kids are beyond that. The Kevin Smith version wasn't for, I don't know who it was for, because that thing got blasted on the internet like it was Kevin Smith, which is too bad because it's actually pretty damn good. Revelations and Revolution. So, yeah, I mean, am I excited? Yeah. Am I wary of it? Absolutely. But what I like is that it's kind of getting people excited about a cheese fest at the movie theater. And I think at this day and age right now, I mean, superhero movies have gotten pretty dour. Every spy movie series that we enjoyed for so long got pretty damn dour at the end. Look at Bond, look at Mission Impossible. So going for something freaking candy-coated fun, I think is great. And I hope that's kind of what it lives to. I want a cheese fest like this again.
Okay. Well, speaking of cheese fest, let's talk about Canon Films. We can go back to 1987. Now, a lot of people say that this was the movie along with two others that were released that year, Over the Top and Superman 4. They think that those were the movies that kind of sank it, and they would be halfway right. And we watching that documentary this week, I saw that it was actually on the downswing before they acquired those franchises. They were way in the red, but their attitude, Matt, it's so awesome. They're like, we're only $50 million in debt. Why aren't we in $500 million in debt? So they decided, I don't know what bank approved this, but they decided to go after Spider-Man. They went after Masters of the Universe. They went after Superman. And after those movies came out, they pretty much folded. And there was an attempt at a sequel that was actually made that we'll talk about when we finish this movie. But Matt, what do you think? Canon Films, their whole history and this movie, I mean, come on, that's pretty awesome, isn't it?
It's a very fascinating documentary. If no one's ever seen Electric Boogaloo, if you have no knowledge about canon, I still think, and you have a interest in filmmaking and sort of the behind the scenes, I encourage you to watch it, because it's an interesting rise and fall. And I think it shows you can have the right spirit, but if you don't have the resources, both creatively and financially, you're sort of on a rudderless ship. And remember, they were bought out by, it was like a $75 million agreement with Warners to handle their assets. And then they looked at the books and they're like, holy crap, that even we can't save you. And this was at a time where Warner Brothers was about to make Batman money hand over fist. But I could see doing this because it's sort of the, and I got to ask you guys, was the cartoon around when this movie was being made?
Well, the cartoon was around, but the thing about it is it had pretty much run its course. Because when they had started production on this, Mattel was all over them saying, you can't have He-Man kill anybody. You can't have He-Man swear. They were really all over Gary Goddard, the director of this, with mandates of what he can't do. But by the time this was about mid-production, toy sales had kind of dipped, and they had He-Man and She-Ra on. Their ratings were kind of dipping as well. So by the time they were almost finished, Mattel kind of threw up their arms, like, you know what, do whatever the fuck you want. So it was on, but it was on its downturn, which I think is a kind of a reason why this flopped as well.
It was definitely towards the downturn. I mean, they started to keep it going. There's toy waves that come out every other year, every year, and they had to keep getting crazier and crazier with what they did. Watch the documentaries on He-Man toys and figures again, because they literally were just coming up with crazy names while they were on drugs. And then they were like, yeah, that sounds good. Stinkor, and, you know, stuff like that. So it lost its way, if you could call it losing its way, but it was on its downturn. Stuff like this only has a couple years. Everybody who thinks their cartoon masterpieces from their youth went on for 8, 10, 12 years, nah, 3, 4 years, 5 at the max, and this was on its downslope.
And I alluded to this earlier from a historical look at the contemporaries. He-Man was not the only one fighting for toy sales. You had Transformers, you had
G.I. Joe,
Thundercats, you had G.I. Joe, you had the Ninja Turtles, like I said. So there was a conglomerate of kind of having to pick and choose your what you purchased. And this thing also, one of the things I think that hurt it was other sword and sorcery films. If you weren't Conan the Barbarian, and even that fell off with the sequel and the spinoff, they weren't doing well. You know, you had stuff like Sword and the Sorcerer, you had Beastmaster, you had, you know, a bunch of other ones in the 80s. None of them could replicate Conan. And this came out at the tail end of that. And also, they were trying to, as Canon themselves said, this was going to be their Star Wars.
Yep. And Adam, you know, going back to the toy thing and how crazy it got. My parents threw the hammer down when I looked on TV and there was a commercial for, Adam, remember the Slime Factory?
Yep.
There was this toy, Matt, where you put one of the figures in it and you pour slime in it and it slimes the character underneath. And I wanted it so bad, but I think my parents saw, my God, what a fucking mess if we were to get that. So I did not get the Slime Factory, and boy, was I pissed. So yeah, that's how crazy these toys got. Yeah, and during the making of this movie, the downturn was there. But let's talk about the director. So who the hell is Gary Goddard? Well, before this film, Goddard had already worked for Mattel. He was redesigning the board game Candyland for redistribution for them. Mm-hmm. But Ed Pressman head producer of this, he hired him based off his Universal Tour production, The Adventures of Conan, a sword and sorcery production. So he thought he could handle this whole production. Now, he went on to go back to work on designing a ton of attractions at amusement parks. He worked on the Jurassic Park ride. He worked on the T2 3D experience at Universal.
So if you look at his Universal credits, so much of that came from him. So many of the classic Universal Hollywood. It's astounding.
Yeah.
And he was one of the key people on the Spider-Man ride, which was really groundbreaking for what dark ride technology could be, to the degree it's still running today, and it's one of the most popular attractions almost 30 years later.
It has also come out since that Goddard didn't really have very good practices when it came to young men, and allegations have surfaced, and if you want details on that, go Google it. For purposes of this review, I will keep it strictly on his work on this movie. So, Canon Films, they ran out of money. They were putting lens caps on cameras to prevent anyone from shooting late at night. And before the production, Gary Goddard, this is what interests you guys, he tried getting Jack Kirby to come to work with the production design, but the studio, they kind of put the kibosh on that. Adam Jack Kirby? How would that have worked?
I think it would have been fantastic. You look at the original concept pieces that really made He-Man break, and I'm talking with Mattel, and you had comic art to break out who and what they were, and it worked with G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe was based on comic art, and they packaged comic books with it to explain to people who these characters were. So those type of artists, and here's a name that's going to come up, Ralph McQuarrie.
Mm-hmm.
Concept artists really make stuff happen, and Jack Kirby is one of the best. And the amount that he did in Hollywood that doesn't get known because he's Jack Kirby, the comic god, I think he would have been pretty awesome, but I think he might have been a little too far out there, being that they took this from space and centered it on Earth.
So to tell you how all sorts of bonkers this production was, it didn't seem like Mattel and Canon were on the same page, because Mattel had a contest where the winner would get to appear in this movie. I remember this contest. I remember putting in for it. By the time the winner was announced, filming was like two scenes from being done. And there were no scenes left to do on Earth. So Goddard just put the kid in a costume and made him a minion who holds Skeletor's staff as he gets to the castle. Now, the original script, which has actually been gone over scene by scene in a podcast, I'll go give a plug, called The Master's Cast, which I listened for this. In that script, written by David O'Dell, guys, we have covered David O'Dell in the past. He wrote Supergirl, and he also wrote one of the big parts of my childhood, The Dark Crystal, which me and Matt actually covered at the old place. There were going to be Snake Men and He-Man's sister, She-Ra. But Goddard approved the costume for She-Ra, and they were in the midst of designing it, and then they were told to cut her out. Canon tried really hard to convince the public that this was going to be, as you mentioned, Matt, the Star Wars of the 80s. So there was a pretty big marketing campaign. Adam, I remember the trailer of seeing He-Man from the back, you know, reaching for the sword as we had voiceover going on. I was really excited. Adam, were you excited for the release of this?
It was, because that trailer just... felt like they live-actioned up the cartoon, and that's all you wanted. It really, really was. So, absolutely, I was ready. And at that point, I was, 8 years old? Oh, God, yeah, I couldn't wait to get in the theater.
Did you see this in theaters?
I'm sure I did. I don't remember. I know we wore the fuck out of that video cassette at home, but yeah, I'm sure we saw it in theaters.
Yeah, I actually did not see it in theaters. I don't know. I don't remember why. Like, my parents were pick and choosy. Like, my dad took me to Over the Top, but he would not take me to this for some reason.
No, you get one Canon film a year.
I actually ended up, I rented it when I was visiting my grandparents. I mentioned this, we talked about Jaws 2. I kind of saw that in the same exact way. And so I brought this home, and I remember watching it and just thinking, okay. That wasn't the He-Man. Like, he didn't change from Adam to He-Man. Like, what was that I just watched? Adam, do you remember your initial thoughts after watching this?
Yeah, I remember that there was no Prince Adam. And guess what? To me, I always want to see Adam transform into He-Man.
Yep.
My wife says the same thing. So to not have Prince Adam at all, I remember being let down. Because as much as I had a He-Man figure, I was probably one of only three people that also had his Prince Adam figure.
I did too. But when this thing opened, and we even had a Burger King campaign, which we get a Burger King product placement in this film, a new toy line, the movie just opened in third place behind the Dreyfus Estevez film Stakeout and the Bond movie me and you guys have covered, The Living Daylights. It opened with $4.8 million and eventually left theaters after only grossing $17.3 million. So pretty big flop. Now, Billy Barty, who plays Gildor, he was nominated for a Razzie for Worst Actor in this, guys. So we'll talk about whether that was warranted.
You know what? And that is one of the things that I remember is Gwildor. Because the cartoon, a lot of kids like us loved Orko. So yes. I do remember walking out going, the hell was that fake Ewok kind of guy that was in this movie?
Yeah. We're once again, guys, I can't believe we're covering Dolph Lundgren three times in the span of 12 months. Here we are. Dolph Lundgren once again coming to the 3 Minute Retrospective podcast. But you know what? At that time, Adam, I felt that was perfect casting. What about you?
Absolutely. I mean, this was post Rocky IV.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. You look at the people that were in Hollywood that would have played it, and Arnold wasn't going to, though you almost could, especially since the original design was based off one of his Mr. Olympia pose pictures. Dolph Lundgren seemed perfect. And you know what? Even looking back at the day, trying to figure out who today could play him that looks the part better, I don't know who you could. So yeah, Dolph Lundgren is as big as a get as anything.
Now, as much as he had the look, there's a great story on that documentary. Matt, I think you know where I'm going with this. Where Sylvester Stallone, who was being paid $12 million to make Over the Top, came to visit this set. And he saw, I think it was one of the scenes of them on the gliders hanging up over the city. And Dolph Lundgren's delivering these lines. And Stallone looks at one of the production guys and goes, oh, God, you gave that guy lines. maybe Stallone had it right. We'll talk about Rocky IV later this year. But guys, that's all the background I have. Unless you guys have anything else to add, let's get into this tremendous story. Matt, do you have anything to add before we get going?
No.
Okay. Adam?
One question. Did you have either of their home bases? Did you have either Castle Grayskull or Snake Mountain?
I had both.
Okay. I was just curious.
Remember Snake Mountain where it had the microphone that you talk into and it echoed and like you're threatening He-Man and things? Yeah, I had them both.
And that's why I'm wondering, because I had Snake Mountain. Oh. And for every kid that had Grayskull, Snake Mountain was a piece of art. That thing was brilliant.
It was so awesome. God, was I pissed it was not in this movie.
Yes, they gave Garrett and I microphones back when we were still single-digit nages.
We get a little introduction to the world we are going into as we see Castle Grayskull being kept in harmony, and the capture of Grayskull is ever in evil's minds, and the power of capturing Grayskull means that they have the power to be masters of the universe. So no text, but right away, guys, we're seeing this Castle Grayskull being surrounded by darkness, and while I really like what Bill Conti is doing with the music here, my 10-year-old mind is like, this isn't He-Man already.
As a kid, I didn't care and didn't understand it. As an adult, watching it for this, I think this is simple, clear, and is a way to get you into it. It's short, it's concise.
I'm the opposite. I am confused 10 seconds in, because one of the things this movie does not do is give you a lot of background as to the status quo on Eternia. I get the gist of it, that you have a warlord who's usurping basically a coup, and you got a group of rebels. Not the first Star Wars comparison we're going to make on this podcast, by the way. But when I enter these fantasy worlds, I want to be acclimated, not thrown in with an anchor tied around my leg.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for a castle. I'm like, oh, you mean the matte painting they just put in? They couldn't build an actual castle? I know it's a canon film, but there are parts inside where the interior looks like it's made out of paper mache.
It probably was.
It is.
Yeah. You know what? I think you might be getting that in this new one, which kind of scares me, because one thing I did like about this and the cartoon, which, guys, I am 30 episodes into the He-Man cartoon. I am rewatching that cartoon for this podcast. They give you backstory, but in little snippets. I am so sick of fucking origin stories. Throw me in. I don't care. Maybe it's just because, again, I just grew up with this character. But Adam, did you need a backstory?
I didn't, but I think that's because I know it. I do think Matt's got a valid point, because this does the A New Hope thing. If it kind of drops you in the middle and doesn't give you a very clear point of where you are in the story. So I do think they could have been, you know, Eternia, 5,000 years of peace and harmony, and evil Skeletor has now Ursa. I think they could have added a few more lines and made it clear. I think that's valid. But I think for the people that went to see it in 1987, it didn't matter.
Well, this was clearly made with the fans as the target. Like, this is not something that was fully accessible. But I want something like The Last Airbender. If you watch the pilot for that show, there's a lot of lore with the nations, and you talk about peace and then the Fire Nation attacks. Like, you get all the information I need to know. That's your launch pad, and I go from there. This, I get next to nothing, And another problem I have is these characters are already fully formed and have a history. I get the breadcrumbs, I can understand, but like my question is, okay, is He-Man like the former ruler who was usurped? Are they just rebelling against Skeletor because he's evil? I don't feel like there's enough here to be invested in their plight whatsoever.
We then move to the not-so-changing countryside. Within the walls of Snake Mountain comes the entrance of Skeletor, played under a cake of makeup by Frank Langella. Now, at this point, Langella was a highly respected actor. It was quite the cue to get him. You'd think that he would be one of those elite actors who would try ever so hard to brush this movie off his shoulder and not talk about it when reminiscing about his career. But guys, the truth is, it's just the opposite. He shows up in all the making of docs about this movie and this character. He makes it clear he did it for his son because his son was a huge fan of the cartoon, and he readily admits that he had no idea what he was getting into when he took this script. But I like him here. I even like Gray Cannon's makeup. It's a little gooey, and you have to kind of squint to recognize him, but I enjoy the Skeletor makeup, and honestly, I enjoy Langella.
Oh, this is what Jeremy Irons watched as research for Dungeons & Dragons, because this is the same type of go-for-broke performance. As someone who has, my knowledge of Skeletor is only memes and listening to clips on The Voice, so I was shocked he doesn't sound like Cobra Commander, like he kind of does in the cartoon, or Krang from Ninja Turtles. The biggest compliment I can give, he's committed. He is treating this like Shakespeare, right down to a Macbethian type with the, I don't know these goddamn character names, besides He-Man and Skeletor, the witch he's got under Evil his Lynn. Thumb. Okay. Oh god, that's a stupid name. I appreciate how he goes for broke, but it's not embarrassing in the way that, like, Tommy Lee Jones did in Batman Forever, which he did for his kid, but he's too big for that. Here, I think, given it's fantasy, he kind of has an excuse. I'm not going to say it's a great performance, but I think as far as embodying evil, I mean, even his costume, they're trying to make it kind of resemble Darth Vader with the armor plates. You know, he's wearing black mostly. It's sort of like they watched Star Wars and took Vader and Palpatine and merged them into one character cosmetically.
I think without Langella doing what he does in this movie, what he brings to it, and the amount of getting it that he gets, this movie would be an afterthought that would be in the dustbins. And for some people, maybe it is. I think Langella is freaking great. I think he sells it. I think he has fun. I think, and this is such a problem with so many things, he knows what movie he's in, and he's playing it like Shakespeare. And he does that both ways. He knows this is a canon film, and his drive, his steadiness to it is what carries this through. And I think it's great. I think the makeup works great 90% of the time. Later on in life, there was a first time that I got crazy with Halloween. There was a type of mask that came in pieces that you had to affix to your face so that you could talk and move. So it was a different type of skull thing. And I got it because it reminded me of this. So I think Langella is more important to this production than probably anybody.
But the one who seems out of it and wants nothing to do with being here is They Live's own Meg Foster as Evil Lynn. They wanted to give her silver contact lenses to kind of play this character, but those eyes are so striking that they were just like, you know what, she looks evil enough with those eyes, so we're not going to touch them. Adam, Evil Lynn, I don't know, Meg Foster doesn't really seem to want to be here, does she?
This is where I started having dreams of these kind of women. I'm sorry, I love Meg Foster in this. Wow. She's the Dario of the 80s, man, especially with those eyes. I think she's beautiful. I think she's stunning. I think she's there for our fathers that had to take us to this movie. But it worked on me as an 8-year-old kid. I wish she was a little more like Evil Lynn that we get, you know, a little more like Baroness, amazingly enough. I can't believe I'm going to say that. Stay tuned for our G.I. Joes. But yeah, I'm good with her in this, but yeah, I can't say that she is kind of unaware of what she's in for.
I can't tell if her scowl that she has in every scene is intentionally how the character is supposed to be portrayed, or if it's her saying, I would rather be anywhere else but standing in front of this camera right now. I think she is a huge bore, considering she does all the dirty work. Skeletor just sits in a chair and takes all the credit, but she's the one who has to like go to Earth later on. And I was expecting something more like the best Bond henchwomen. I wanted something more like that, where there's a playfulness, you know, for a witch. She doesn't do anything that cool, for lack of a better word. So, I don't know if this is representative of the character from the cartoon, but as it stands, she is pretty bland. She reminds me of Annie Ross in Superman 3.
Yeah, the next year Willow would come out, and while I'm not a huge fan of that movie, I do love the witch that's in that movie. I wish Meg Foster would have kind of played that card. She just doesn't seem like she wants to be here. Again, I wish she did something with this role, because Evil Lyn in that cartoon is, I mean, she's just flat out evil. You know, she's got some really big moments. She laughs evilly. Like, everything about her screams bad, and Meg Foster is just there. So the castle is secure, and we're closing in on Thanorion as we speak, as we're told. And boy, you talk about wooden, this plot.
What plot? It's a giant MacGuffin.
Yes.
It's hot potato with a MacGuffin.
Yes. Evil Lyn assures Skeletor that they will have He-Man before the day is out. And Skeletor stops Lyn from saying Grayskull is theirs. He says, it's his. Again, Langella just going all out with these lines. All right, so let's talk about Castle Grayskull and Snake Mountain, or the lack of the latter. I will say that the matte paintings and the design done for Grayskull look amazing. The sets, not so much, but once again, my 10-year-old mind just wanted to rebel because I didn't have my Snake Mountain. Apparently, they did do matte paintings for it, and they had it all set to be built, and then Canon Films came in and said that's not happening and scrapped the plans. Adam, as somebody who is really, really high on these matte paintings from this time period, how do you feel they did with Grayskull here?
My issue is that it doesn't look like the Castle Grayskull that we played with. It's fine, but that's not the shape of it. It doesn't have the big skull drawbridge that was only elongated because they built it before the toys and they couldn't fit He-Man in the mouth, so they had to stretch the mouth. Ugh, God, 80s toys. It's fine. I love matte paintings. So on that, I think it's kind of cool. Once you get inside, you got some decent matte paintings with some really, really bad production stuff in there. But it's fine. But I'm really disappointed that it doesn't look like Castle Grayskull from the toys or the cartoon or anything else. I know there was some fighting between Filmation and Mattel and this. Filmation had some rights that they were not going to give to the movie. That comes up with some problems. But I just wish it looked more like the toy that we played with.
Me too. We then see that the sorceress is his prisoner. Now, we don't see how this happens. We just see that she's just at his captor. And that kind of boggled me too. How did this happen? It did happen in the cartoon, but we'd always see how it happened. They're just really trying to take some shortcuts here.
They are. 5 minutes in, you're like, oh, that's right. This did have canon at the beginning of it, didn't it?
Yeah. The sorceress is just spouting cheesy dialogue like the dark can embrace the light but never eclipse it. Oh my God. Skeletor then gives her some sort of spell while saying, can you feel this? And then he gives a last starfighter type message. That's what I always think of when I see these big heads on these lands, you know.
Okay, stop right there.
Okay,
who is he talking to? Because there's nobody in Eternia, apparently.
There's like seven people on this planet.
Yeah, and all the people you see are his minions. There's no citizens. There's no like townspeople. It's just the rebels and his like stormtrooper looking people that look like the extras from Spaceballs. And all of these exterior shots of Eternia look like the Planet of the Apes sequels where they ran out of money.
Well, who he's talking to is who we see right away. We have the He-Man character who's standing here looking at this message. Okay, I have a major issue with this character, and no, it's not Stallone's criticism he gave on the Canon Films doc. It's that this sword is what makes him special in that cartoon, but in this movie, he's just a dude with a sword that is far from what it's actually called, which is the Power Sword. In regards to Lundgren and his shitty delivery, Goddard actually wanted to bring in another actor to dub Lundgren's dialogue. He hated it so much, but he couldn't for contractual reasons. I guess in Lundgren's contract, he had so that he was given 3 attempts to get it right.
Yeah, I guess apparently they needed the second unit director to be wearing an umpire's jersey.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this should have been 3 strikes and you're out, because I think he is atrocious in this.
I do,
He might look like He-Man, but he's got the modulation of a empty swimming pool and the charisma to match.
Yeah.
And my confusion is also, this is one of my questions about the lore of He-Man, which, God, I'm very confused. So is Adam, as a Thor fan, is this like a Donald Blake situation with the hammer?
Yeah, pretty close to it. It's, depending on which way you go, the Power Sword is actually 2 different swords, but when you put them together, then you get the Power Sword. Hmm. And yeah, him wielding the Power Sword is what transforms him into He-Man. So yeah, that's actually pretty damn an apt analogy.
And I have a big problem too. At the very end, when we finally do get that I have the power, he doesn't even say by the power of Grayskull. He just says, I have the power.
And he doesn't transform. He just gets dressed.
Yeah. Yeah, Goddard took Lundgren into the studio after the production was over, tried his best to correct these lines in post, but I'm with Matt. I think Lundgren is pretty bad in this.
Oh, boy. You know what? I'm really glad he's got his PhD in the things that he does, because if this didn't work out, he'd fall back. It's not just his delivery. He doesn't know when he's what he's laughing at. He seems completely off mood, depending on the moment. It just doesn't make... He looks great. That's it. Full stop. And just because Canon is too freaking cheap to let him record three times to get somebody else in is why we get this. It's amazing that him and Arnold toe-to-toe for so long, and Arnold was Conan, another basis for He-Man, and dubbing problems and European, it's kind of crazy just how they almost parallel each other until they don't.
Well, Dolph Lundgren never had a James Cameron. It helps to have somebody who could take an actor like this and make something of him. Schwarzenegger would be nothing without James Cameron. I seriously believe that.
Well, to an extent, because I think John Milius did a lot for him in Conan, where he recognized his limitations, but he's got charisma that I don't think Dolph Lundgren possesses.
If we ever get that King Conan movie, maybe we'll do those.
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah, other than just looking great, and look, when he's got the straps on and all that, he looks like this is kind of peak Dolph, even when you take Rocky IV into account. But just make him mute, because God, he's bad.
Yeah, like this is one of those instances where I think dubbing would have actually been beneficial. I mean, they spent it on frickin' Superman 4 with Gene Hackman dubbing Nuclear Man.
Yep. We're in the midst of dust as we're seeing He-Man just kick these nameless guards' asses. We're even seeing guns go off.
Oh my God. Okay. This is one. I get this is a canon movie, so I have to put this qualifier. But the editing job in this movie is atrocious. You can't see when he's swinging the sword because they close up on his fucking chest.
Yes.
And this is a thing, like, this is like the 90s X-Men cartoon where you couldn't have Wolverine using his claws to, like, stab people. He would just retract them and kick them. So this is one of those things where standards and practices was clearly in effect, because that sword stays clean throughout this entire movie.
And these stormtrooper type guys were a mandate from Mattel. Because as I mentioned, He-Man can't kill anybody. They
we cannot
want.
Kill any humans. Can't so these are humans. All technically robots from She-Ra.
Good point. Robots from She-Ra, and they are about as dangerous as a toddler with fucking cotton balls, because they fly away at the shot of a gun. They're pretty bad.
Yeah, no, it's amazing because, you know, She-Ra would not be able to kill a human, so she got robots in her iterations, and they transported them here. It's not good. Though, anytime LaGella speaks, I'm immediately brought back in.
Same here.
Have we talked about the opening credits yet?
No, go ahead.
Oh, thank you.
Because I had this note written down. Did they forget they were not making Superman 4?
Thank
because
you.
Because the opening sting of that score, combined with the credits themselves, like with the space text and the font, I'm surprised John Richard Donner didn't sue these bastards, and if I was Christopher Reeve in 1997, I would have been so offended I would have gotten up out of my wheelchair and changed the channel.
Well, in the words of Rocky, sue them for what? Honestly.
I was blown away because I forgot, and yeah, this is full-blown theft, the way the music and the way that they just fly on screen. It was Jesus.
It's also weird when you look at the casting order, because Billy Barty is top billed.
Yes. Yeah.
And my thought was like, okay, they're going alphabetically, but then they bucked that trend three names in, so they couldn't even keep that consistent.
Man at Arms says, thank the sorceress that He-Man is still alive, and him and Teela say that they were just betrayed. And this is when we meet Gildor, and my 10-year-old mind is like, what the fuck? What is this? Apparently, rumors are abound that we're going to be getting Orko in the post scene in this new He-Man movie. So maybe we'll finally get him. But Adam, Gildor, even back then, I'm like, come on, what are we doing here?
I didn't like him then. I don't like him now. I mean, this is a post Return of the Jedi, man. We had this Willow. It was kind of the thing to have short statured actors doing these type of almost troll type roles. But he's annoying as all shit from the beginning till the end. He's got a few moments that make me laugh as a kid, as an adult. But other than that, he's just annoying. And he is a really bad Yoda ripoff. I mean, you might as well just be like, mine. The way he eats, the way he does things. Frank Oz might as well sue him over this.
Well, I was thinking of, this reminds me of like Hoggle from Labyrinth. Because this was like, all these movies had like a small actor or sometimes a short woman in the costume, and then they'd be dubbed by somebody. This felt very in line with what was the trend at the time. I do find him obnoxious, but it's not to the degree of some of the other ones where I just want to pull my hair out. I get he's here for a younger audience, but I yeah, it's an 80s cartoon, but one of the things that also annoyed me, this movie has no teeth. Not just because they're caught in that Halloween costume that Frank Langella is stuck behind, but be that as it may, I was surprised at the lack of... Tension's not the right word, but I think of stuff around this time, like Neverending Story's got some really dark stuff in it. Return to Oz, one of the more infamous ones. Even Labyrinth. Those darker fantastical elements seep their way in, but they still have an overall feeling of whimsicalness and fantasy. This doesn't have any of those peaks and valleys. It's very drab for most of it in tone. And I think sometimes it's kiddified to a fault, which is also weird because when they go to Earth, they're not interacting with pre-adolescent kids. They're dealing with teenagers, which also makes it off-putting.
There's nobody under the age of 17 when we get to Earth.
There's nobody, period.
Hey, we get the late James Toback later. Yeah, I'm with you. Although it is quite literally dark because there are times when I can't even see the fucking movie. Gildor shows them why he's so important to Skeletor, as he also mentions that he remembers the days when he didn't have to lock his doors, and he then shows them the cosmic key. He says that he wishes he hadn't created the cosmic key prototype, and that it is the most unique key in the universe as it can open the door to anywhere. He-Man puts together that this is what Skeletor's men came for, and this is why they surprised them.
You also think from a storytelling perspective, they would put in the preamble, as brief as it is, something about this key being like commissioned by Skeletor to be made, because it just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay, so this is going to be the big device that everyone's after, which this was a thing in a lot of fantasy films at the time. You had to get an object, go look at Excalibur, among other things. But I was annoyed that there was no explanation. It's just, oh, it's here, and why does it act as a synthesizer? I'm already so confused as to what's happening. And apparently he lives in New York because he's got the same lock mechanism you can find in those cheap apartments on the west side.
Gildor explains how a beautiful woman showed a lot of interest in this key, and I love how Man-at-Arms has to clarify for the audience. That must have been Evil Lynn. Everything is just spoon-fed in this fucking script.
Oh, this guy is freaking Burt Ward Robin, where he just accentuates to the audience, here's what you need to know, yes, by asking qualifying questions to explain what the movie does not feel preoccupied with explaining.
Yeah, he's manned exposition for this film.
I have a feeling this is not how Idris Elba is going to handle this character. An alarm goes off as guards are at the door, and they head to the caverns underneath Grayskull. And he says that he doesn't like adventures as the guards enter to secure the room. Again, who's this fucking creature with the hair metal cut? Yet another bout of contention for my 10-year-old mind.
This movie feels like rejected Power Rangers with these villain designs.
Beastman was the one who was supposed to be heading these guards and ordering them around. But once they designed the fucking makeup for it, the guy couldn't talk. The mechanism would not allow him to say anything. So they had to give that stuff to Evil Lynn. And this Beast Man just might as well be one of those creatures from Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China. Because that's what I thought of every time I saw him.
Yeah, you hope to see the people that you played with your toys and that you watched in your cartoon. And you kind of get one that almost looks like Stinkor, maybe, and then he's gone. And then you almost get this one, and Beastman is barely even visible. It's a shame. And to me, it thinks that some of those rights between Filmation, Mattel, and this got crazy. And God knows that Canon is not one for actually paying anything. So I can see them just going, fuck it, we'll make them ourselves.
Make our own toys. Which they only made one of. These toys, the one that you mentioned that looks like Stinkor, that's the only one that they made a toy of in this.
Yep, it's not Stinkor, everybody, for legal.
No, it's not Stinkor.
I can't wait to talk about Star Trek so I can put you guys in my perspective right now, because you're just espousing nonsense.
This is what happens when you guys start talking Marvel. I feel the same way, Matt. We just went through this. They find the sorceress, and she says that Skeletor has imprisoned her, and they are all in danger. Gildor says that he can open a door for her, but as he types in all the keys, guards enter and part a way for Skeletor to enter. As he says, everything comes to those who wait, and he has been waiting so long for this moment. Me too, Skeletor.
This is also one of the funniest Lundgren reads. Let her go.
I know.
If I'm Skeletor, I'm like, are you asking me? Are you telling me? Because I don't know. I can't read your tone.
Hey, God, can we do a second take? No. cut print. Sounds good.
It sounds good to me. He explains how the sorceress's power will become his, and she will die as he rules the world. He tells them to throw away their weapons and join him, but Gildor's key starts working, which causes the guards to start attacking. He-Man is using the sword to deflect these bullets. Gildor opens the door, screaming, "It's working!" as a portal opens, and the sorceress tells He-Man that they must leave her, which they do as they jump in the portal. He-Man grabs Gildor, who drops the key, but the key is taken by a grab hook and goes with them before the guards can get to it.
George Lucas must have loved this line so much, because that is Jake Lloyd going, "It's working!
Yeah.
It's working!"
So you're saying
they love Star Wars too, because nobody can hit anybody.
So Adam, you're saying that Billy Bardi probably deserved that golden raspy, huh? Raspberry.
If this is the movie you put out, it's not a Razzie film. It's a canon film. That's just picking on the dumb kid.
Skeletor says that he wants that key and he wants to possess all or nothing. And his parting words are, "Find them." So we see He-Man exit the portal and find Gildor, who needs to clean his ears, much to the delight of Man-at-Arms and this bland Teela. God, this fucking Chelsea Field. She annoys the fuck out of me. 4 years later, she'd be cheating on Joe Hallenbeck in The Last Boy Scout, and she's just as annoying here. Can't stand her. So
funny, she was like a lot. Like, she was in Commando. She was in, I don't want to say she was a get, but I was like, oh, someone I recognized.
Teela tells Gildor to get them home, and he says all they have to do is punch the Energizer switch. But they notice the key isn't with them, so they separate to scan the area and find it. They find a cow, which Gildor tries to communicate with.
Okay, where? This is supposed to be California.
Yep.
There's no fucking cows to be found in the middle of California unless you're on a farm. They're not just out in the wilderness.
And I will say it's amazing that they get here, and I'm like, yep, I've been to Santa Clarita. This is across the freeway from frickin' Six Flags Magic Mountain, which this is where so many things are filmed, but I'm like, yep, I know this area. This is cheap-ass production central.
That is the ultimate calling card of this movie. Starting the trend, in this one it's purely cost prohibitive as the reason, of taking these characters that live in a fantasy world and dropping them off in the real world to get home. I mean, yep. I was sick of this before I watched this movie for the first time because I've seen it done so many times and almost none of them work. This and the Garbage Pail Kids around the same time, like I think that was 88, maybe. It's the same thing, and it's a trend I've never liked because it's always because of trying to save money and we can't spend all the time in Eternia because the meter's running, literally. So I found that annoying, because if you're going to do this fantasy world with these characters, I want to see them in their element, especially because they don't do anything that fun in the real world, like the cheap fish out of water type of humor, outside of a handful of scenes. And I don't think you need all your fingers to count them. They don't have a lot of fun with taking them and putting them in California. I guess also because they couldn't afford to shoot in New York, which was the popular thing at the time to shoot there.
Yep. He-Man gives a plan that Man-at-Arms just scoffs at before telling them good journey and leaving. We then cut to Robbie's Diner, which, as a little aside, was the location of the infamous Rodney King beating, by the way.
Yes.
And here's yet another entry of Courtney Cox on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast. God, is she young here. Holy shit.
So young, she might as well be dancing in the streets. Look, I remember her as a kid and liking her. I didn't even put two and two together when I started watching Friends as a teenager until later.
Yeah,
but you could kind of see this as a star-making performance. And such a cheesy, I mean, between this and Leprechaun, it's amazing that we got such famous people out of some of the films we did. But
yeah, both on the same show, ironically.
Yeah,
and the sorceress in this is Ross and Monica's mom.
Yes.
Julie says that Kevin's changed and it's time for them to move. She goes to the car, and I love how the whole crux of Kevin's well-being is being checked here. Kevin is bummed that yet another bucket of Robbie's ribs is what they're having for their final dinner together, and Julie reveals that she wants to go to her parents' graves to bid them goodbye. And all of this is happening just right in front of Teela. She moves across the street and almost shoots Man-at-Arms, who is apparently also hungry. Teela is making fun of a couple in a car as Gildor... There's another set of people in the movie, Matt. In California, this couple in this car.
They walked onto the set. They were just there getting food, and they decided to
Yeah, these are just it. Extras that they probably filmed during one of their makeout sessions and because they weren't paying attention.
As Gildor takes the ribs that are in the car with his little grappling hook. He swears he was going to share. Man-at-Arms is really taken by the food, and Teela is just confused why they put the food on those little white sticks. She says she thinks they've wasted enough time, as Gwildor says he thinks the phone tasted good. This is all just silly stuff. Meanwhile, Julie is blaming herself for her parents' death, as it was a plane crash that killed them, and she said at the time that she had to study as she wanted to spend time with Kevin, and Kevin says that they wouldn't want her going, her whole life blaming herself for their death. Am I the only one who thought maybe this plot point was going to be solved by the source first committing some sort of magic to bring them back?
Yes, well, you were.
I knew there was going to be some resolution to this, because otherwise you would not devote this much time and this much quote-unquote effort into a backstory for a supporting character.
And guess what? There's no reason to put this much. Even what they do with it, the way they use it, there's no reason for it. You have a movie without that, it changes nothing. You can have another way to get where we need to later. This is something that, for 75% of its inclusion, just leaves you scratching your head.
They leave the grave as they see the cosmic key just laying there. Of course, Kevin sees it as a modern-day synthesizer. Meanwhile, Evil Lynn tells Skeletor that the cosmic key has been activated, and Skeletor says to send the mercenaries next time the key is triggered. We then
this is the bounty hunter lineup from Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, we're getting there.
Yep.
We cut to He-Man as he moves through the city, but we see Kevin and Julie in the gymnasium as Kevin is testing out the cosmic key, thinking it's the synthesizer. But of course, this triggers it as portals are open, and this is when we meet the mercenaries. Here we go, as Matt calls them, the bounty hunter lineup. The finest warriors include Blade, Serod, Beastman, and Karg. Not a bad set of makeup, but even as a kid, I was like, this isn't Beastman, and who the hell are these other guys?
Oh, boy. I mean, the outfits don't look good. You can't really put red shirts on them because they're the wrong side. But, you want the toys you played with.
Yes.
And they don't do this. Blade. No. I know who Blade is. He's got a sword, but he's a black guy. This isn't.
Yeah.
No. I want the toys. That's what I'm here for. And this isn't it. It's not done well. I guess you got to have some sort of action because this cartoon action movie is missing it. But this is. Ooh, this is bad.
I think even Gary Goddard knew this because he has Skeletor call them a curious quartet. As a kid, I'm like, fuck yeah, it's curious. Where's my fucking Stinkor? But they must get He-Man, who keeps slipping away from him. Meanwhile, Kevin wants to take the synthesizer to Charlie, his friend, as Julie just wants to spend some time in the gymnasium alone. Kevin leaves as Julie wallows in a little bit of pity, but this is when the curious quartet, as Skeletor calls them, show up. They take out a guy who tells them that they can't just show up, and Julie walks in on the fight. Gunshots are going off as Karg says that she may know where the key is. Beastman comes after her as she hides under the stage. Blade puts some blades through the stage, but Julie manages to get away as the gymnasium just goes up in flames. I can't believe they were able to afford to put this sucker up in flames, but here we are.
I think they just recycled the set from Carrie.
Well, they recycled the set from fucking Hellraiser 3 for the street they go down.
Or Back to the Future, right down to the actor who's in
this. Yes. Julie is still running as the quartet keeps chasing her, and some stormtroopers also show up, but He-Man is here to rescue Julie as he promises not to hurt her. He fights off the henchmen as he gives Julie a gun to protect herself. He-Man takes out Go ahead.
The guns. Do they have, like, blasters?
No. They do. Man-at-Arms has one.
Yeah, maybe one or two people, but they don't. They are not walking around. It's not Cobra and G.I. Joe. No.
No, I was thinking Star Wars.
Oh, no.
That's what I was thinking of with these blasters.
No, even though he uses a sword like a lightsaber to deflect them? No.
Yeah, normally when the energy comes out, it's like from like a diamond or something that has some majestic properties to it, not an actual blaster. But yeah, I think you're right, Matt. I think you're right on, because Canon was very upfront by saying they wanted this to be the Star Wars of the 80s, and this is how you do it. You give these guys blasters. He-Man takes out the troops as Julie gets a shot off at Serod. He-Man fights off Beastman before Blade shows up and says he has waited a long time for this. Swords are clashed, and we even see that Serod has fingernails that extend.
Yeah, apparently he's Lady Deathstrike.
Yes.
Yeah, or he's a Nuclear Man.
No, good point. Man-at-Arms and Teela show up right in time to fend them off, and He-Man tells them to find them as they must have access to a door to Eternia.
Now remember, they were all looking different directions to go for their own perimeters.
Yes.
But somehow they're all here at this gym.
He-Man then tells Julie that he's going to need her help. And then we cut to Kevin, who shows up at Charlie's shop and shows off the key. Charlie says he's seen these types of instruments before. They're Japanese. But he changes his tune when he sees the key at work. Kevin says that if you've seen one, you've seen them all. And he tries taking the key out. We then see that cops are all around and they tune in on the cop channel to find out that the school was the victim of arson. We cut to Julie, who tells He-Man that he has seen the key. He-Man says since Kevin is in possession of it, he's in danger, so they take off toward him. And then we see the school being taken care of as Kevin can't find Julie. And this is when we meet Detective Lubick, played by the late James Tolkien. God, guys, between this, Back to the Future,
Top Gun,
he was just a product of those 80s, wasn't he, Adam?
He was, and I can't hate on him. Does he got one type of delivery? Yes, but he's almost like Michael Ironside. You need a role that is specific. You know the type of people you're going to get, and this was that kind of guy for that kind of role. So he's perfect for what he does. As bad as it is, this is who you get.
The one thing this movie did not need was more human characters. like if I was a He-Man fan, I'd feel very shortchanged that they're literally for the pink Cadillac is a literalization, because they take back seat from this point on for a considerable portion of the movie.
Lubick tries getting Kevin to tell him what happened, as Kevin just wants to know where Julie is. He-Man introduces Julie to Teela and Man-at-Arms, and is it just me or is Teela looking at Julie with some sort of resentment here? You know, in watching that cartoon, I have to say, this is from that cartoon, because every time a female or somebody else He-Man is helping, is talking to him, they always cut to Teela and she's always looking at them like, you better fucking not touch him. Adam, did you get those vibes?
I wasn't looking. I wasn't paying enough attention. I didn't get that, but I would understand it. I know they never really are a thing, but no.
Gwildor pulls up in what looks like Christine, the car, and I love these controls in this car that he has.
It looks like the freaking Care Bears vehicle.
Yeah, it
does. Like, I have expected them to be in the trunk.
We cut to Skeletor, who is still starved for power. Evelyn says that in order for Skeletor to rule completely, He-Man must be destroyed. The quartet then show back up without the key, which pisses Skeletor off. And when Karg tries giving excuses, Skeletor just takes out Sarod. Well, how is this helping? By taking out your henchmen.
Well, it's because, okay, we don't have enough pay scale to pay all four of you guys, so we got to keep one of them. We only got one of you for a day.
The one person that almost looks like a toy that I had.
I know.
Let's get him off screen.
Yeah, the one that had the most clear effort put into the makeup is the one that got rid of the quickest.
Yes.
Because Blade might as well have duct tape to keep those things on his face and his hands.
Skeletor decides to send Evil-Lyn with them, and they leave. And then we cut back to Earth as Lubick and Kevin go to Julie's place. Julie is calling, and Kevin obviously doesn't want to give away that it's Julie on the phone. She verifies that he still has the key and says that she will meet him there.
Okay, another logic question. So her parents are dead. Is she living by herself in this giant house?
Matt, I have to say that I did not think of that question all the time. I watched this movie a lot as a kid, but I haven't seen it in at least 15 years. That question came to my mind for the very first time in this viewing, is how the fuck is she keeping this fucking property upkeep?
No mention of guardians, no mention of like my aunt and uncle. It's just apparently a high school kid working at a fast food place can afford a house of this scale. I guess that goes to show.
Well, 1987, I wouldn't put it past it.
First time, I got questions. I'm like, wait, so the parents died. They died recently. However, they're already buried and they got headstones. And for anybody that's sadly ever had to go through that, the headstones take a while, everybody. You get a temporary marker. But the house is clean. But she's still in high school, but she's leaving right after. Like, this
they
is
sold the problem. The house already.
Yeah. This is the problem with the dead parent storyline. Put that on the poster. It just doesn't. I don't know. I can't even imagine being an 8-year-old again trying to figure that out.
Lubick asks what the key is, and he starts mashing buttons on it. He then states the obvious. I don't think this is a synthesizer. In the 80s, it was all about synthesizers, wasn't it, Adam?
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, the only thing that would have been better is if turn this into a guitar synth. Remember when you had the keyboard guitars?
Yep.
Oh, tears for fears.
Meanwhile, Evil-Lyn and the cronies show up, and Lyn looks at what happened before, verifying that they weren't outnumbered. They were just outclassed.
Random technology that she could look into the past with this little freaking thing. This doesn't make, oh my God.
None.
This would answer so many questions. And all Skeletor has to do is wait, because at the stroke of midnight, he gets all the power. You don't need to be here.
Yeah. Like, well, just wait. The other problem of this whole quest for the MacGuffin, it's independent of Skeletor's goals. He doesn't need it to become master of the universe. So why are we making such a big deal about it?
He just prevents other people from going to where he's going to rule. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't give him any bit of power whatsoever.
No, if they would have just hinted that maybe Skeletor and He-Man have battled for so long that He-Man has always thwarted his plan, so he must get rid of them one last time, bam, you got it.
Meanwhile, Lubick opens the portal as Kevin eats a bucket of fried chicken, and I like how the microwave is jamming the signal.
You could tell microwaves in home was a fairly new thing.
Yes.
And in 1987, they would have been. Like, not everybody had a microwave at that point.
And also, who the fuck puts a bucket of chicken into a microwave?
That's what I thought, too. Because there's no way that bucket wasn't partially foil lined.
I know.
And also, Burger King doesn't sell chicken in a bucket. I don't think they ever did. So
this
what?
Is from Robbie's. This is from the place she works.
Okay. Well, still, they shamelessly put that burger. Also, was he going to that disposable Burger King cup that's clearly on display in the sink?
Yeah.
Was he intending to wash that and then put it back in the cabinet?
Well, you don't take stuff that or still has liquid in it and just kind of place it in the sink until the next morning, and then you just dump it and then put it in the trash?
I do it that day.
Oh, okay. Mr. High Class over there.
And this guy's clearly not considerate of Julie because he just leaves her house a fucking mess. And he can just walk in. He can just walk in anytime he wants, apparently. He doesn't need a key.
Yeah, I know.
The cop doesn't break down the door. It's just wide open.
Doesn't bother turning on a light. Yeah.
No, but they're still on anyway.
The troop destroys the microwave as Lubick keeps trying to find out what that cosmic key is. He then says that he's going to report the cosmic key is stolen. He takes the key out and says that he has a set of cops watching over Julie, and he then leaves the house. We see this Burger King product placement as Evil Lynn and her squad show up at Julie's house. She tells Beastman to leave him alone, and she tries getting Kevin to give away where the key is. They put this collar on him, and apparently this is like a truth serum.
Yeah, it's the lasso from Wonder Woman.
Yes.
But it looks like the thing from Wild Wild West.
The squad continues tearing up the apartment as they also find some newspaper clippings detailing what happened to Julie's parents. Kevin tells Lynn under influence that a cop took the key as Karg shows Lynn the clippings about Julie. They get in a ship and take off as we see the car pull up to the house. They tend to Kevin, who still has a collar on. He-Man asks who put the collar on, and I love how these characters just have to repeat each and every new plot point to another character just to make sure the audience understands what's going on.
There was a story that came out recently about how Netflix requires their original films to restate what happens multiple times, and everybody denied that so fervently that you know it's the truth. Clearly that started way back here with movies designed this way. It's just, hey, in case you forgot what happened in the scene 2 minutes ago, we're going to tell you again.
They get the collar off and Kevin starts freaking out a little bit. Kevin's mad at how these things are showing up as Gwildor walks in looking like he's had a grand old time.
Oh, he like E.T.?
Yeah. Kevin says he wishes he'd never seen the key as he tells them that the cop is headed to Charlie's place. We then cut to Charlie's as Lubick asks if the key could be Russian. I love these questions. The car parks and Lubick says, "What do you know? The mountain has come to Muhammad." Lubick calls He-Man Blondie. James Tolkien has all the great lines here. He does have only one fucking pitch, but it's pitch perfect for this stupid ass plot.
He's probably making the shit up as he goes.
Probably. As Gwildor warns of Lynn approaching, Lubick says that they're all in trouble, but they leave anyway. And then we see a whole setup outside as Evil Lynn is determined to get this damn key. Man-at-Arms says that he's feeling a little bit hungry as Gwildor gets a map of where Grayskull is. Another thing that really pissed me off, even as a kid, Adam, and correct me if I'm wrong here, the Grayskull in this is spelled G-R-E-Y instead of G-R-A-Y. And it's G-R-A-Y in the cartoon. That pissed me off. I don't know why.
As a kid, I had no idea. Right now, I'm too old to care. I want my Snake Mountain back.
Gwildor says that the universe is music. As Kevin says, this reminds him of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And Lubick says this reminds him of a cult.
And Matt's like, yes, it does.
The troops attack, and we get a gunfight. The gang try holding them off as Gwildor is hard at work. The clock is ticking as Man-at-Arms says it's not that the troops don't like them, it's that they miss them. He-Man fights off more troops as Lubick asks if World War III is going on. Teela then tells Kevin to not let Lubick out of his sight as she throws the gun away and then once again throws Julie a look that might as well be laced with daggers. That's the one fucking thing that Chelsea Field can do, is look through you.
Mm-hmm.
Lubick tries screwing things up by saying Kevin and his friends are going to jail as Julie sees her mom walk out of the darkness. There's a struggle between Kevin and Lubick as Julie approaches her mom, who says they had to disappear as they've been doing ultra-secret work. And Julie is buying this bullshit as her mom asks Julie to grab the shiny thing that plays music for her. Little aside, this chick that plays Julie's mom, real-life mother of Chris Pine. So there's a Star Trek reference at Matt. The fight continues as Guldor tells them to stop acting like immature babies, and he fires off a shot. Julie shows up to grab the key and leave. She gives it to her mom as she thanks Julie and turns into evil Lynn right in front of her. Julie realizes what a dumbass she is as she screams, and Guldor yells for He-Man to once again possess the key. Charlie and Lubick, they walk into the store, which has now been destroyed. Lubick gets his hands on a shotgun as the troops fire back with, guess what, even more guns. This causes Lubick to say he might need some backup. No shit. Evil Lynn walks up with the key and says that she will send a signal to Skeletor as they take off. Guldor says that they're opening a very big door as the troops file out. And we have the hoverboards. God, did I want these. Between this and Back to the Future 2. Speeder bikes
from Return of the Jedi?
The hoverboards?
They're those speeder bikes.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, like speeder bikes in the air. Skeletor shows up looking like he's on a float in a parade.
He looks stupid in this parade float, and I hate how this is one of those movies where your all-powerful villain does nothing but sit in a chair for 90% of it.
Yeah.
So when everybody shows up, though, there, you got speeder bikes, and Matt's got the speeder bikes. You know what I thought of was Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
When he's on those, especially the haircut, the big blonde guy who's there to save the day. I'm getting so much cheesy Flash Gordon out of this at this point. It's kind of crazy. And why does Skeletor show up? Dude, just stay at home. Turn TV on at the castle. Watch something. Just stay home and everything works out.
Yeah, Evil Lynn is handling this just fine.
Yes.
Lynn tells him that she has the key as Skeletor sends the troops after He-Man. He-Man fights them off as they head for the roof, and He-Man grabs Guldor's grappler as they jump on a hoverboard.
Could Sam Jones have played He-Man at this time?
You know what? I think that would have worked.
I could at least understand him.
I don't think he has the build. He had the haircut. He looked more like He-Man. That haircut looked like Prince Adam. But if anybody else, yeah, Sam Jones.
They head towards Evil Lynn, and He-Man fires off some shots. He grabs the key and is then attacked. And I love how Lundgren just lets out a Drago type, yow, as he's getting attacked here. He takes out another troop and he's in pursuit of another. Guldor can't find the signal of the key as Man-at-Arms is worried that they won't be able to leave in time. Skeletor then shows up and tells them to throw down their weapons. They do, and Skeletor thanks Guldor for all the trouble he's caused. You know what? And I just figured out that Frank Langella's kind of been absent for the last half hour or so.
This is one of those things where, like, he's gone for a big chunk of the movie.
He says he expects He-Man at any moment as he sends the troops to take them away. He-Man then walks into a trap as Skeletor sends some force lightning into Julie's leg.
Which is crazy because it's just like, it's a trap. What's the trap?
Yeah.
Also, these people must love Return of the Jedi between the speeder bikes and saying it's a trap.
He-Man fights off the guards until they overwhelm him, and Skeletor says that if He-Man makes another move, his friends won't live to see another day. He tells He-Man to surrender his sword, which he does. Skeletor then calls him noble as He-Man is taken away and says, good journey.
Oh my god, fucking good journey. Oh.
Hey, it's how I'm closing off this podcast. Don't start.
Hey, it's how I came to school every day.
Yeah, same.
Back then. Yep. But the way it's used, it is used at inappropriate times here as much as Dolph Lundgren starts laughing at inopportune moments here.
Oh yeah.
Every now and then.
Skeletor calls He-Man his slave as he says, let the others rot. Guldor says the key's core is melted down, so there's no way back to Eternia. Lubick is being laughed at for there's not being enough of an army like he said there would be. Kevin watches as they cover Julie's wound, which is pretty ugly, and he's told that the poison is running through her system. I did not remember this, but my god, this fucking big bruise on her leg, it's pretty gnarly.
It is. This force lightning has some extra stuff to it.
No shit. Guldor says the tones in the key were erased, so it's next to impossible to open it. Kevin himself says he can remember them, and I love how Teela just shoots the speaker to shut off the music. That was actually pretty funny.
Between that, she has a line where she calls herself a woman at arms. Teela's such she's used almost as a fourth side character, but when she's got little moments, I like her quite a bit.
That's also the worst editing job in the movie when she shoots the speaker. Oh my god, there's like frame missing. It's so bad.
It is.
It's like Chewie shooting the freaking cameras in Star Wars.
Kevin starts remembering the tones, and Guldor asks how he did that, and fate brought them here for Kevin to save them. But Kevin starts doubting himself, saying that there's a million of him, as he's just a keyboard player in a high school band. And Adam, we knew a few of these people in our school.
Yeah, and it's one of those two. I mean, it's such an 80s thing. Like, music is going to save the world. It's going to bring us together. You got these new things. It is such a 80s moment, but it also plays.
It's Man-at-Arms who convinces him to stay, and Gwildor says that he can get the key going again if he can get a few things, which includes something to play the notes on. Kevin says that he can retrieve that.
I hate how they only made this character a musician to justify this plot.
Yes.
Yep. Fucking hate this.
Meanwhile, He-Man is brought before Skeletor, who claims victory in front of the sorceress. The sorceress, who is aging right in front of our eyes, says that...
Yeah, the fucking Beetlejuice.
Yeah, plant. I thought of that too. Says that men who crave power make mistakes and end up on the edge of destiny. Oh man, do they give her bad lines. Skeletor insists He-Man's sword into the throne, and then Skeletor tells them to witness the end of Eternia, and if He-Man doesn't kneel before him, he will wreck harm in He-Man and the sorceress.
Yeah, kneel before Zod, Skeletor.
Yeah, between the... I mean, look, this is already... He-Man by its nature is homoerotic, but between this, the whipping...
Oh yeah.
I thought we were going to get 50 Shades of Grayskull.
Kiss my bone.
50 Shades of Grayskull?
Bravo. Yeah, that's the line.
Very well done, sir. This is when Blade obtains an energy-filled whip and starts whipping He-Man with it.
For everybody that had a problem with this in The Acolyte, here you go. It's a freaking... Here's your whip lightsaber.
Is that in The Acolyte, too?
Everybody threw a fit over a lightsaber that was a whip.
Wow. Because it's Star Wars. They will bitch about anything.
Meanwhile, Lubick says that he was in Korea and he never saw anything like this. As Kevin drives by, he shows up with the keyboard and tells Gwildor to press the keys to get the tones. Gwildor is impressed with the sound that the keys make, and I actually had one of these types of keyboards when I was a kid. Kevin promises Julie that he'll never leave her, and she says, "I love you." Meanwhile, He-Man is in a bad way. He's still getting whipped as his strength is disappearing, but even at this point, he refuses to do so. Skeletor says as He-Man dies, Skeletor himself will be reborn. We see Lubick preparing to attack Kevin as Skeletor has yet another message for Eternia as he proclaims himself Master of the Universe. We see some energy enter him and he starts turning gold. I do love the fun that Langella seems to be having here, but again, this gold was never established in that cartoon, was it, Adam?
No, and I don't mind the color change. I do mind the headpiece that looks utterly ridiculous because he looked badass through this whole movie. Now he looks like he belongs on that parade float.
Yeah, remember at the end of the Dark Crystal when there was that tremendous moment where he does heal the crystal and those creatures turn into those things that they start talking but you don't see their mouths move because of the fucking headdresses that's on them? That's exactly what I thought of here, is this gold just doesn't work.
Well, there is so much in here. If you watch this back-to-back with Dark Crystal, you're just...
Oh, yeah.
You can make one movie out of the two.
Mm-hmm. And it would still suck.
Hey! Don't you dare fucking thrash Dark Crystal. It's one of my favorites.
I already did.
Yeah, you did. That movie review did. Skeletor is getting that unstoppable power as he insists that they kneel, and now he's a god. Flash of gold light later, Skeletor is, again, in all gold. Meanwhile, as Kevin starts hitting the keys, Lubick tries throttling that plan. Skeletor tells He-Man to start telling him the benefits of good as the car lands in front of them, and Lubick is just in awe here. He's like, what the fuck am I doing here?
I kind of liked about this is that it was cut away. Like, yeah. The car's in half. It's only got part of the building, like, outside. It made me chuckle even now that I'm like, they didn't just transport it. They, like, cut it away.
Another firefight ensues as Skeletor breaks his promise to not hurt his friends. Lubick then unloads his shotgun at the troops as He-Man starts taking out troops with laser fights galore, and guards overreact as they're shot, and He-Man just seems like another dude here. That's what I don't like about this. He's not the same superhuman hero. He's just a guy hiding behind a pillar as he's getting shot at. And I feel even when he has a sword, he's like this.
Yeah, he doesn't feel any more or less special than anyone else. And I feel like that's why this was called Masters of the Universe and not He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, because the movie's not really about him.
No, he's along for the good journey.
But He-Man reaches his sword and Skeletor says he wants his face out of his forever, and this should be their final battle. Their swords clash as gold light and shadows are abound. They even get in a room.
And they cut the power to save money.
Yes, they even get in a room filled with red light. But He-Man finally makes Skeletor into his former self. As He-Man says, it's finally over. Skeletor says, it is over for He-Man, that is.
He has his line.
Yes. The fight continues, and here we go. Okay, Matt, you touched on it, but let's go. Budget issues abound. Gary Goddard had to finance the rest of this fight himself because Cannon Company was like, nope, we are not giving you any more money. So Goddard just paid for the rest of this himself, which is why it's all in dark light. We see nothing around them. God, it's anticlimactic would be an understatement.
Yeah, this is where cost prohibitiveness bears its ugly head, because for something that's fantasy and basically two demigods fighting each other, I've lasted in the bedroom longer than this fight lasted.
It's a shame because you get your showdown, you get your moment, you get He-Man raising his sword and saying, I have the power, not by the power of Grayskull, so yep. Fuck Grayskull and the sorceress apparently, but you know, okay. But you get the moment, and then we cut to this just real, I mean, I understand that you needed to still have this final showdown, but holy bet, man, this looks bad. It looks bad, it's shot bad, it's lit bad. I walked through haunted houses with more ambiance than the room they filled this in.
And we're not talking like high price haunted houses, we're talking like local haunted houses.
No, I'm talking like walking through an old strip mall that gets converted.
Yeah. But He-Man knocks Skeletor into the nuclear reactor, I guess.
Yeah, this is Palpatine falling into the Death Star reactor.
Oh my gosh. Yep.
And this is when they proclaim victory. We see Lubick in a good way, out here in Eternia, being served at every whim as the sorceress gives Julia a gem. Julia and Kevin are on their way home as she and Kevin tell everyone good journey.
Good journey.
He-Man tells her to take care and then tells Kevin to look after her. Gwildor then sends them home as she kisses Gwildor and tells them good journey as well.
Journey.
Julie stops and yells for Gwildor to send them back as they go into the light. We see her wake up and walk through the house, which is surprisingly lit now. And wouldn't you know it, her parents are still alive.
Oh yeah, it's the ending of Jumanji, where they reset the game board and their parents didn't actually die in a ski accident.
I've never seen that movie, believe it or not.
The revive? Yeah. I'm like, wait, is that what happened?
That's what happened.
I spoiled a 30-year-old movie for two people and I've never fucking seen it.
Damn, Rock.
Julie tells
Wrong Jumanji.
Julie says that she loves them both and she convinces them to not go to the plane in Catalina. She then grabs her dad's keys and walks out. Kevin runs down the street and hugs her as she says that she already stopped her parents from going. They hold the gem as we see Castle Grayskull and He-Man proclaims he has the power as credits roll on Masters of the Universe 1987 to a post-credits scene of
one of the first ever.
Skeletor raising out of some red liquid proclaiming that he will be back.
Wait, you're fucking serious?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Did you not know there's a post-credits scene to this?
My response indicates no.
Jeez, Garrett. Yeah, this is one of the first movies that ever had a post-credit scene, and most people had no idea till video. But this, even in theatrical, this was there for it. So at the very end, suddenly it's, apparently there's a river at the bottom of that nuclear reactor, and it's all red. Skeletor pops up, looks into the camera and says, I'll be back.
And he's all green, too. Like, it's different color schemes and everything.
Yeah, kind of looks like Scare Glow.
Yeah.
Sorry, different He-Man character.
There were plans for a sequel, but we'll get to that here in a bit. Let's get to our final rating. Scale of 1 to 10. Adam, what do you give Masters of the Universe?
This movie is a product of the 80s. It's a product of its time. It's a product of drugs and cheap production companies and Canon Films deciding to slash a budget on two different movies so they could take whatever they cut to make a Spider-Man movie. Guess what? That didn't work out. This was made... I can't even say it was made for kids. It was made to... talk kids into making their parents bring them to a movie theater for one of the biggest toys that existed at the time. But by the time this movie came out, those toys were on the downslope. By the time this movie was done, those toys were gone and out of fashion. It's had a resurgence in the last couple years, and so has Masters of the Universe. And people are looking at this film again, and I'm glad that we did too. This movie's not good. This movie is shot pretty poorly. Its locations are cheap. Its production design is not very good. Its sets are inexpensive. The acting is flat and more wooden than the sword that Dolph Lundgren is carrying. And at the end of the day, I have an absolute ball when I watch this movie because it is that cheesy kind of fun that I wish we were watching at the same time and drinking while we were watching it. But I can also acknowledge that's because I was a kid playing with these toys and I can make fun of this while still enjoying it. It's amazing that the titular character, I guess not really titular because this isn't He-Man, but that's what people still call it, is one of the least interesting parts of this. You know, Man-at-Arms, Teela, and even Evil Lyn are more interesting and more fun to be around than He-Man. But this is Franklin Jella's movie through and through. I think he is amazing in it. I think he knows what movie he's in and he goes for the gusto. I almost wish that this was just a straight villain movie. The time on Earth, not great. I talked about where it was filmed. I talked about that it looks like we reused sets from other movies, and that's because we did. They couldn't hire background extras for most of the scenes. This place is more desolate than Santa Clarita after 10 p.m. on a freaking Saturday afternoon. Those that have been there will understand that. this is, it's cheesy, but it's 80 cheese, and part of that is fun for me. This thing is hard to score because I'm like, do I go with my feelings or do I go with what the movie is? And I had fun while I watched it. I'm giving this a 6. Nope, I'm giving this a 7. I had fun. These are my toys. This is my childhood. It is not a good film. It is a fun film. And for me, that's as important as anything else. It's 95 minutes. Thank God this thing isn't any longer. Probably because they couldn't afford any more film. But yeah, I mean, other than Bill Conti ripping the hell off of everything that came before, the score still works. But man, I will live and die with this movie solely for Frank Langella's performance as Skeletor. So yeah, I'm going to be that guy and go ahead and throw some tomatoes at me. But this is a 7 on 10.
Hulk gets a 3. Masters of the Universe gets a 7. Wow. All right, Matt.
I had fun. That's the amazing thing. My wife was listening to me watch this movie and stuck her head out from upstairs and was like, what the hell are you watching? Because I'm just,
I'm happy that I watch these like when Jen goes to bed so that I don't have to hear her reaction half the time. Although she was in the kitchen during the end of this and she kind of poked her head around a couple times. All right, Matt. Well, as somebody who has proudly endorsed some pretty bad movies in the past, I have a feeling Masters of the Universe 1987 won't be one of them. Go ahead.
I'm going to be contrary to Adam's opinion, because if this is 80s cheese, I did not have a Gouda time watching this, because when you said it was 95 minutes, my comment was, that's it, because I found this to be pretty poorly paced and not an enjoyable experience. And I can't attribute that to my lack of knowledge about this property, because I've seen plenty of things that I am not a fan of get adapted. And either I appreciate it or it retroactively makes me a fan of the property or some kind of new appreciation. And I also have to put the handicap on this for being a canon production, but I can't have fun with this in the same way that I did with something like the Ninja movies or Over the Top, or to quote another Dolph Lundgren movie that's not canon, at least I don't think it is, I Come in Peace. I like that movie. This to me is like the bad example of adapting a property, both not from the sense of cynicism, because this has a charm to it in the way that, like, we'll talk about Roger Corman's Fantastic Four. I think it's got that right kind of spirit, but they did not have the resources or the talent to fully utilize it correctly. The biggest problem also is for something with He-Man at the focal point, he's far and away one of the least compelling aspects, and it's not just because of how the script is written. I think Lundgren's performance doesn't do this any favors. And if it wasn't for Frank Langella, I would be a lot harder on this movie than I am. But don't lead yourselves into thinking that I'm going to give this a good stamp, because I found this to be tough to get through, even on the standard of canon productions. This is not as like offensively bad as something like Superman 4, where I feel like that also, as we talked about a couple years ago, was made with the right spirit, and clearly Christopher Reeve gave it his all, but it, like I said, just didn't have the money or the resources. This is the same thing. I guess I'm going to be nice and give it a 4, because there is a certain inherent charm to some of the production design and some of the costumes, and I put that in quotes, but I can't say this is a good movie, and I can't say it's 80s fun, because like Krull, I feel about Krull the way Adam does about this movie, and I would much rather be watching that.
Oh God, I have a real backstory with Krull if we get to it.
Yeah, let's review the glaive.
Yeah. I'm surprised we haven't seen a remake of it. I am right between you guys. And Matt, you kind of throttled my thoughts and my outlook of this movie by saying that even knowing the background of canon films and even seeing that documentary, it didn't even enhance this viewing for you one bit. Because in 1987, I felt the exact same way as you. I was just like, where's everything I played with? What are things that make this as good as I loved it when I was watching the cartoon? There's none of that here. Everybody's in these drab costumes. I think nobody but Frank Langella is having a good time on this set. Well, maybe James Tolkien. I find the line deliveries he does to be pretty damn funny. It's a very drab film. However, the fantastical element of this is kind of what ups it a little bit for me. Lundgren's not good here, and when you have a movie based around He-Man, you need that character to be good, and He's been warmer to it lately, but he's even come out and said, look, I did not enjoy the experience of making that movie. There was no way I was going to go back to that character. I feel that here. I feel the drabness here. But I also feel filmmakers trying their best to bring the fantastical element that people love so much and what got them this property. And you gotta give Canon Films this. They went all out. They got the property, but once came time to make this movie, they realized, oh shit, we don't have anywhere near the resources to do it the right way, so let's just get it done. They got it done. It didn't make too much money. It has seen a little bit of a resurgence lately, but it's still a pretty damn bad film. I am going to be nice as well. I want to give it a 5. There's nothing to really like about it, but there's nothing to really hate about it either. And Adam is absolutely right. Every single time Frank Langella is on screen, you cannot help but smile. So 5 out of 10 for me on 1987's Masters of the Universe. Boys, this is going to come as no shock to either of you, but there were plans for a sequel to this movie. Dolph Lundgren reportedly wanted nothing to do with it, deciding to do Red Scorpion instead. So they hired this surfer guy named Lard Hamilton to take over the role. And, Matt, it was announced that Albert Pune, who we will be talking about soon, had taken the reins of director. It was going to be released close to the release of their planned Spider-Man film as well, which they were going to make based off the profits of this film, as Adam just said. But after all the movies that they had done this year had come out, Canon Films had massive financial difficulties. They even refused to pay Mattel for the royalties and use of these characters. So Mattel was not happy with the script. So the planned sequel was scrapped. Though Canon did not want to waste the sets that they had built for the Masters of the Universe sequel, so they reworked the script, kept Pune on as director. Pune cast Jean-Claude Van Damme in the role, and we got the movie Cyborg. Which, if you watch Cyborg, the outline of that Masters of the Universe 2 script is there. Adam, have you seen Cyborg?
I haven't. I know the story. I know of that. And it's one of those that I've always meant to, because I know that's what that movie was gestated from, and I've just never got around to it.
If you think this movie's drab, try getting through Cyborg. I tried rewatching it a couple years ago. It is not good. But we'll talk about all the other plans for sequels and reboots next week as we review the finally done Masters of the Universe feature film that is going to be released in theaters by Amazon. We've kind of given our outline of what to expect. I want to go ahead and say the only thing that kind of scares me about this movie is I never ever wanted to hear the backstory of how Adam got to be He-Man. And it looks like we're going to kind of get that in little spurts, but I am liking what I'm seeing. Hell, I'll say it. I like what Leto's doing with Skeletor in those trailers. And they are doing a good job of keeping Leto as far in the background as they can and not really talking about the fact that he's in this, because he's fucking box office poison. Matt, what are you feeling as we finally get to theaters and see another He-Man film next week?
I hope it's good, because they spent almost $200 million on it. And I have to say, the one thing that does concern me above everything else, 4 listed screenwriters. That's a little worrisome. And anything Jared Leto touches lately has been crap. And my question is this. If you're feeling the need to mask him both in your marketing and modulating his voice, which they clearly have done, then why are you casting him in the first place?
All good questions that I was definitely going to bring up next week. Adam, we're getting closer. We've had 2 trailers. What are you thinking going into next week's film?
I'm hopeful. Amazon Productions doesn't give me a lot of hope. Look, yes, we all saw, well, I don't know if we all have, but I mean, the population has all seen Project Hail Mary, which is Amazon, but I give that to Lord and Miller for being as brilliant as they are. Release the proper solo film. I hope it's good. I hope it strikes the right tone. The trailers have seemed a little lack of color for me. You know, I don't want it being drab. I want more of that cartoon feel, but live action-y. Idris Elba, man. I mean, Jesus. I love that the guy just has fun and does projects because he wants to do them. I think he's going to be in this movie kind of like Langella was in this one, where, look, I want to do it, so I'm going to do it. And we got a Battle Cat, so I hope we have Panther. I'm hopeful, but I'm still a little restrained because I don't know if they can balance that proper tone to make it successful. So I hope, but I don't know. Please don't be 2.5 hours. I don't know how long it is, but please don't overstay your welcome.
I tell you what, Jen's excited. Either she's excited or she's putting on a face for me, but she says that she's going to be there with me opening weekend. I can't wait to review it with you guys. But until next week, when we get to Masters of the Universe, good journey. Thank you, boys.
Good journey.
People of Eternia! I stand before the great eye of the galaxy, chosen by destiny to receive the powers of Grayskull.
This inevitable moment will transpire before your eyes, even as He-Man himself bears witness to it.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
I don't like conventions.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
I guess this is really goodbye, huh?
Big Army only means one thing. More targets.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, the ongoing Marvel films, films of the DC universe featuring Superman and Batman, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, Avatar, and so much more.
What do you think?
Sounds great.
God, I wish it would shut up. Well, thanks.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Skeletor. It's over.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
I have selected your finest warriors.
A Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, and Dave.
Are you a master? Yes, yes, you are. I know that.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I feel like I'm in the Twilight Zone or something.
Scheduling done by Matt.
Someone is speaking to me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
It would be a pity to waste their talents.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production, copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
Tell me about the loneliness of good, He-Man. Is it equal to the loneliness of evil? Huh?
Good journey.
Good journey.
Good journey.
Trying to get a hold of you for like 5 minutes.
All right. Bullshit.
No, I've been called. I'm like, Adam, are you there? Are you there? And then Matt got on, so we just went through a whole thing.
Oh, I think you were on mute when you were calling him.
Thank you so much, honey. Yeah. I love you.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
She just
Jen.
She just dropped off 3 egg burritos just right here.
Oh, for the purpose. Thanks, so, Jen.
Yeah. So, Matt.
Yeah, I remember that there was no Prince Adam. And guess what? To me, I always want to see Adam transform into He-Man.
Yep.
My wife says the same thing.
You've been holding that joke for a while, haven't you?
No, that just came to me.
Nice.
She said as well. So to not have...
So, Adam, you're saying that Billy Barty probably deserved that golden raspberry, huh? Raspberry.
Yeah. If this is the movie you put out, it's not a Razzie film. It's a canon film. That's just picking on the dumb kid.
He reminds me of frickin' Snarf from Thundercats.
Oh, see, Thundercats was past my cartoon watching. I never got into Thundercats.
God, I need that live action movie now.
I'm sure if you go to a furry convention, you can find it.
I was going to say furry time.
Skeletor says that he wants that. Kevin's mad at how these things are showing up as Gwildor walks in looking like he's had a grand old time.
Oh, he like E.T.?
Yeah.
I thought they were going to do the thing from, like, which movie is it where the kids go into the strip club?
I don't know. I watched a different movie, but I'm ready to watch it.
Is it an 80s movie?
Was it Adventures in Babysitting?
Adventures in Babysitting?
Oh, they don't go to a strip club. They go to, like, a nightclub.
Yeah, but that's what that's where I was thinking he went.
Okay. Kevin says he wishes he'd... The fight continues as Gwildor tells them to stop acting like immature babies and she fires off a shot. I'm sorry. The fight continues as Gwildor tells them to stop acting like immature babies.
I'll be back.